We delayed a little bit to let more people be seated. We have three argued cases this morning, and as probably most of you know, we will have a change of panel after the first case, and we will then adjourn for 10 or 15 minutes and return with a slightly modified panel. First case is Association for Molecular Pathology et al., a lot of al, versus Myriad Genetics et al., 2010-14-06. Mr. Castanhas, we have, as you know, allowed extra time, but we would hope and expect that you stick reasonably to the allotted time.
Thank you, Judge Lurie. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. If I could beg the Court's indulgence for a couple of moments at the outset, I'll frame the three arguments that I'll make this morning. The first argument is our jurisdictional challenge. In the words of this Court's decision in Prasco, there is no real and imminent controversy that is traceable to the defendants in this declaratory judgment action. The only actions that occurred that were alleged to be performed by the defendants occurred long ago, and the district court's ruling in this case boils down to saying that Myriad's ownership of these patents is enough on their part to sustain a declaratory judgment suit on only a few of the claims.
Mr. Castanhas, yes. This isn't just an academic dispute by a few organizations or people opposed to gene patents. There are, among the plaintiffs here, physicians who would carry out tests. They've signed affidavits. As of fairly recently, saying they could or would engage in competitive activities. Myriad hasn't told them that they're entitled to a royalty-free license and that they wouldn't enforce their patents, have they?
No, Your Honor, and I don't think that's required by the...
So why isn't there a real controversy here?
Well, it's because this Court has asked for two things out of a declaratory judgment controversy. There have to be either actions or meaningful preparations by the declaratory plaintiffs, and there have to be, in the words of Sandisk, Prasco, and other cases of this Court, affirmative acts taken. It's a little too cute to say, but it does take two to tango.
There were letters sent out. One of them fairly threatening.
In 1998, I believe, and nothing has happened with regard to those.
Yeah. Nothing happened, actually. Counsel, didn't the recipients of the letter, the University of Pennsylvania Laboratory, cease and desist just like the letter told them to do?
They did in 1998.
Right. So why aren't they still laboring under that threat? Myriad threatened them. They altered their behavior as a result. Why aren't they still laboring under that threat? They have no reason to think at this point in time that that threat is removed, that Myriad has ceased to feel the way it did when it sent them the cease and desist letter.
No, I think they have enormous reason to believe that that threat has been removed. If you look at the record in this case, for example, you have declaratory plaintiff Chung, who says that she's right now doing the sort of sequencing in her laboratory that
But not for clinical purposes. That was the distinction, correct? Myriad says you can employ these techniques for research purposes, but not for clinical purposes, as I understand Myriad's position.
Well, I believe that we've said that you can employ them for clinical purposes, but you know, we haven't said...
Well, that's certainly her understanding from her affidavit,
again,
is that
right.
She's not free to use them for clinical purposes. Are you saying that's not right?
Well, I'm saying that that's subjective. I mean, that's really, Judge Bryce, and you're putting me, on behalf of my client, to the choice of having to tell you today that we will grant everybody here a royalty-free license so that they can do whatever they want in whatever way that they want.
All I'm addressing is your assertion that this Dr. Chung says she's free to do whatever she wants. Well, her affidavit makes it clear that she doesn't think she's free to do whatever she wants because
again,
she can't make use for clinical purposes, right?
And I think that's right.
Am
but
I
that's
reading
what
that
she that's what she feels, and that's her subjective view, and that's fine.
Based in any way on a position that Myriad has taken with respect to the distinction between research and clinical uses.
It's certainly not based on any immediate position that Myriad has taken.
Is it
based on a position Myriad has taken? I can't get into her brain. I believe she says that she did, and so I'll take her at her word.
Okay.
But you know, what we have here is that Myriad, the last affirmative acts that Myriad took with regard to these patents were over 10 years before the suit was filed. And that's against MedImmune's requirement of a real and immediate controversy. And the questions that I'm getting, Judge Bryson, from you and from you, Judge Moore, are aimed at the other half of the declaratory judgment inquiry. As I was saying, it's a little too cute to say it takes two to tango, but it does take two to have a declaratory controversy.
No, yes? Counsel, I guess I'm looking at it as they're very much laboring under the continued threat of Myriad. The fact that Myriad said cease and desist 10 years ago or 12 years ago, well, they did. What reason do they think to have to think that Myriad is not still feeling very much the same way? I mean, Myriad had the power and authority to modify it. If they were no longer feeling that way, they could have let the plaintiffs know. They could have offered a covenant not to sue, but Myriad has declined to do so. Now, I'm not suggesting a covenant not to sue is required in any old circumstance, but in a circumstance where there has been an actual threat, an actual modification of behavior, maybe it's fair enough to say at that point the burden is on the patentee to show that the threat is not continued and real.
I think that you could imagine a case with different facts than this one where that might be appropriate. But what we have here is, we've said in our briefs, is a controversy that has largely been brought to the courts many, many years after the fact. You know, if there was a threat in 1998, then why wasn't the suit brought then? If there was a suit, if there was a threat perceived in 2005, when Ms. Matloff says that she called Myriad and received a call back saying those would be covered by our patents, why wasn't that suit brought then? I mean, there have been a number of this court's cases where less stale disputes, if you will, have been rejected with regard to declaratory judgment jurisdiction because the dispute certainly wasn't sufficiently imminent. And that's what we have in this case. I think there's another problem, Judge Moore, and we pointed this out in our briefs, that the claims in this case that are challenged were selected by the plaintiffs themselves. They are only 15 out of 179 of the patent claims that are in the seven patents that are in suit here.
Is this your redressability argument?
This is the redressability argument, Judge Moore. And if as they say, in fact, if you look at their affidavits very closely, you will see that they perceive the threat not from these particular claims, but from the patents as a whole.
So it's my understanding that they cannot obtain the relief they've sought unless they had challenged and possibly invalidated all the patents, because under the technology PCR, the probes and primers, none of that was challenged.
Correct.
There's no other way to obtain the relief sought.
Correct.
Absent using those.
Correct.
Well, you brought it up in the reply brief, which is fair game for a standing issue, of course. But we haven't gotten to see what they might offer in way of response to that yet.
I would like to see also, and they obviously had the opportunity, had they wanted to file a 28J letter on that or with regard to anything else in the reply brief, but I'm looking forward to that as well. And I think there is a significant problem with redressability because, you know, what is it that made these claims special? Why did they pick these claims for this case? I mean, there's a suggestion in a CNN article, which was in the record, that Mr. Ravitcher, the counsel for the plaintiffs, said that they just had to pick one case as their case and they're really going after all gene patents everywhere. And, you know, if this is going to be the first brick in the wall, so to speak, well, that's all well and good, but that's really showing that this is a hypothetical dispute and not a real one.
Mr. Castanis, you've appeared before us on many cases and you represent people on both sides. Aren't you troubled by the breadth of the district court's standing in this case? I mean, to reach individual people who want cheaper access to products, it seems to me, would be so broad as to allow any person that wants a cheaper product in any case to sue. I mean, gosh, Apple and Microsoft and everybody else would be sued by every consumer out there.
Well, I mean, even going aside from electronics, Judge Moore, I appear before you as a lawyer, but I'm a patient to a doctor sometimes, and I'm a patient who has to buy prescriptions at the drugstore. And if I want a generic drug that's cheaper, then I guess we don't need Hatch-Waxman anymore. I can just go in and file my own declaratory judgment action. I think the court appreciates the point with regard to the declaratory judgment.
But we have a multitude of plaintiffs here, not just a patient. We have physicians prepared to conduct tests who are in competition with Myriad. Potentially in competition.
Potentially in competition, but again, what has Myriad done to them? And again, with regard to affirmative acts aimed at anyone, there are only arguably three plaintiffs who might fit that. Those are the doctors at the Pennsylvania laboratory and Ms. Matloff. And even then, the act of Myriad was only the response to a phone call, which I think this court made pretty clear in Innovative Therapies. You know, they're not going to let declaratory judgment be based on the sort of the gotcha of calling and saying, well, you know, can I practice this patent?
Well, you're leaving
I'm sorry.
We're
yes,
on the same point.
Yes,
go
you're
ahead.
Right. You're right. I left out Dr. Oster, but that's the same. That's the same with regard to the Pennsylvania labs. The same condition. I would. Well, I think this case should be dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. I'd be remiss if I didn't get to the merits. With respect to the composition claims. Isolated DNA does not exist in nature. It has never existed in nature, and it never would have existed in nature except for human ingenuity and research.
Before you get into the,
sure.
the nuts and bolts of your argument, I just want to understand the scope of what you think your claim covers. If I were to endeavor to sequence the entire human genome, would your patent claims, the claims to the BRCA gene, read on my effort?
You want to sequence the entire genome?
The entire human genome, right.
Well, again, I have...
Of an individual. I mean, I am going to sequence my own genome.
Right. Okay, well... Again, I think one of the problems, of course, is that this points up the lack of a meaningful dispute here, but I recognize that this case is made for hypotheticals and line drawing and all
is,
that.
But,
so.
But it's to me, at least, it's an important question as to
sure.
how preclusive your patent and any other patent on any particular gene would be if, in effect, you have to get 100, 200, 1,000 licenses before you can... sequence the genome of an individual. I'm not sure
that my client has formed a view on that, and I'm not trying to avoid the question. With regard to the logical consequences of the claim construction, of, or at least of the meaning of isolated as it's defined in the guidelines, is in the PTO's utility guidelines. As long as the BRCA DNA is isolated, I can't imagine why that
wouldn't be covered.
Right, no, it wouldn't be covered because it wouldn't be isolated. If it were isolated, that would
no,
be a no, different story.
As long as you don't isolate that particular gene, if you do the genome test in something other than a gene by gene. Sequences.
Well, I would think that's right because what you're really talking about is the entire genome in effect in the same way as it is in your body. Now, again, the claims, the broadest claims here are drawn to an isolated DNA.
Yeah.
Now, if it's isolated, then arguably there's infringement.
Make sure I understand the science. So in Judge Bryson's hypothetical, it's the whole chromosome, therefore not isolated, therefore not covered by claims. You're not claiming the whole chromosome.
That's correct.
Right?
That's correct.
So, but if you do it on a, let's say, as I understand, one of the sequencing methods would be to take 32 nucleotide segments, one after another. If you do that, does that create a problem either with the any of the claims in general or specifically with respect to the 282 claims, I guess, 5 and 6, the 15 nucleotide segments?
I don't think it does if I'm understanding your question, Judge Bryson, because the definition of isolated includes separating the BRCA gene from the other genes in the genome. And I don't think what you're suggesting there would be that.
Does that include separating from introns as well?
Separated from introns, I would think that would at least arguably be covered by isolated, yeah. The main point with regard to the district court's error here is that the district court read into Chakrabarty, into Funk Brothers, a sweeping, and we've been pretty clear in our brief to describe it as a sweeping products of nature exception. What we can fairly easily admit that, as set forth in Chakrabarty, that a new mineral found in the ground or a new plant found in the wild is not eligible for a patent under 101.
If a new mineral found in the ground is not eligible, what if it's, you know, embedded in rock? You have to perform extensive excavation. You have to apply some sort of acidic substance to peel away all of the rock, effectively breaking the bonds that connect the mineral and the rock to each other. Mm-hmm. How is that really different than isolating the DNA?
Well, I'll answer it in two ways. First of all, I think it's not on some level different from isolating with respect to Section 101. Now, what you described, Judge Moore, is a rock with an embedded mineral in it, and then you have applied human interaction to separate it. Now, that is a composition of matter. It's within the language of the statute, and it is otherwise eligible for a patent. Now, the problem is, Judge Moore, just to finish the answer, is that that patent would fail, unless you give me more facts, under Section 103, under the Funk Brothers analysis, because all you've done is the work of an ordinary skilled artisan with a jackhammer.
Or maybe even 102.
And maybe even 102, because somebody else did it before.
Well, at this point, why haven't all you've done is the ordinary skilled artisan? I mean, as I understand it, these geneticists are capable of doing this in quite routine and immediate fashion, and you can pick a gene in your body, and there's nothing particularly unique about BRCA1 as opposed to the gene for pancreatic cancer or the gene for Alzheimer's or any of these other genes. So why isn't this very much the skilled artisan in this field?
Well, again, this points up one of the problems, Judge Moore, with doing this with this coarse filter of Section 101. Now, Section 101 is not sensitive to sorts of things like the level of ordinary skill in the art. There's been no finding on that ground by the district court. There's been no finding with regard to what was known in 1995 when these patents were applied for. What's being argued is that there's this products of nature exception that it applies to this, and Judge Sweet, of course, says it's unique to DNA, but I think now that we're in an appellate court, we can see that this decision is going to have consequences for all sorts of areas, including other areas of the biotechnology industry. That's just not, those aren't considerations under Section 101.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can we go back to my hypo real quick before we move on? So my hypo about the mineral, is your position then that the mineral embedded in rock that takes the efforts of man to separate the rock from the mineral to get pure mineral, is your position then that mineral is now a patentable composition of matter and should be patentable subject matter under 101? Forget 102 and 103. Is your view that under 101 that mineral qualifies?
I would say that yes, although it presents a close case, it is patent eligible under Section 101.
But isn't it just something found in nature?
Well, it wasn't just found. I mean,
isn't
now you're sort of changing
that. The mineral is still the mineral when it's attached to the rock and it's physically compressed, but it's not chemically joined as a different molecular substance, whereas your gene is distinctly different in the isolated state from what it is in situ.
And we can certainly live with that distinction, Judge Lurie. That reflects sort of the CCPA's novelty analysis that said that if something is different in kind rather than different in degree.
Doesn't it reflect science in fact?
Well, it certainly does reflect science in fact, at least as I understand it. Again, you know, hypotheticals I have to add a little bit more based on what I assume to be the ordinary level of skill with regard to the extraction of the rock. But one could imagine all sorts of inventive technological contributions that had to be made to get a rock out of a particular medium. We could just add facts, and so, you know, why should that rock be a composition of matter, but the rock that just took very simple work not be a composition of matter?
Tell me why.
When you say it takes complex efforts, I mean, mining can be a very complex enterprise, but you're not suggesting that mining for diamonds, which can be very expensive, difficult, and technologically challenging, renders the diamonds that are ultimately found patentable, right?
Oh, no.
And are you
I don't think I used the word complex. I think I tried to use the term inventive. technological contribution. I mean, the patent system is a reward for inventors.
So are we saying then, with respect to the distinction between what is, as Chakrabarty referred to, a mineral found, discovered in the earth,
mm-hmm.
we distinguishing between a mineral which has to be subjected to a process that breaks covalent bonds between the mineral and some impurity that is not desired, versus a mineral that has to be treated, let's say, with a solvent to wash away those goods that those surrounding elements that are not wanted, where there are no covalent bonds that are actually broken. Is that the distinction we're to rely on?
If you look at the line of cases that has run from the late 1800s to today, you really do see that sort of distinction coming out of the cases. You know, if the mineral that's claimed as the result of your hypothetical patent is not functionally or structurally different than the mineral as it was in the ground, I have no problem closing the door on it at 101, and I think that's consistent with our position. But if there's invention, if this is the result of an inventor and it wouldn't have been there, it wouldn't have been added to the so-called storehouse of human knowledge but for human intervention and human invention, I want to be very clear about that, then I think there you've got a line.
But presumably the invention can't consist of a new drilling device that is able to go much deeper and discover this mineral, even though when it gets down to the depth, that the mineral turns out to be in its native state.
No, I think that's right, and I think then you have to add a few more facts there to see the mineral where you're breaking the covalent bonds and you're creating something that really is new. And this is why I think that although the cases I think are not clear over the course of history, what you see distilled out of the cases are that you have Chakrabarty that says a product of human ingenuity. That's the language that I hope the court will focus on.
Why isn't ingenuity the process as opposed to the resultant DNA, which is in your body? Why isn't the ingenuity the process of extracting it, the process of figuring out what it's useful for? Why is the ingenuity the thing? I mean, God made it. Man didn't make it.
Well, I mean...
Sorry, not supposed to say God in court, I know.
Well, I'm going to do it anyway, Your Honor. So imagine a baseball bat. I learned in English class when I was in grade school that only God can make a tree. But
no, the
man
the
can
answer
make a baseball
is in golf,
bat.
Only God can hit it one iron.
I would have preferred for purposes of my hypothetical that you used wood instead of iron, but I take the point. But the point is that what we have here are new tools, things that molecular biologists use. As Dr. Kay said in his declaration in this case, these are the products of molecular biologists. They're not the products of nature. They're not the products of God, if you will. These represent, again, quoting Chakrabarty, a product of human ingenuity. Just the tree, the baseball bat's inside there, it's the reason the baseball bat works is that it's got these particular qualities that are inherent in the wood. But I think, and I'm pretty sure I've seen patents, even maybe discussed by this court, that baseball bats are compositions of matter, manufacturers, patent-eligible subject matter. If I could very quickly turn to the method claims, because I'm getting close to running into my rebuttal time.
It's your time.
With respect to the method claims, I have... 3 points very quickly. First, and I think we've made this pretty clear in our briefs, Judge Sweet committed a claim construction error. He seemed to view the term sequence, as it's used in the method claims, as referring to strictly information, strictly a series of letters.
Well, the method claims talked of analyzing, comparing, detecting. Isn't that all thought processes of visualizing as opposed to concrete steps?
Judge Lurie, I think your opinion for the court in Prometheus answers your own question. The court's Prometheus opinion looks at a claim that says determining and says, well, it's necessary.
Determining is not in these claims.
Well, actually, it is in the claim 20 of the 282 patent. But
claim 20 stands in a rather different posture.
It does stand in a very different posture.
That says growing.
That's a growing, determining, comparing claim. But with regard to the analyzing or comparing what? And the claims are clear. A tumor sample from a human subject, a germline sequence of a BRCA1 gene, these are things that are pulled out of a human body, and there's a necessary transformation. And I think, again, Judge Lurie, the opinion in Prometheus answers the claim on the other side about in re grams. This is not a case where this is just mere pre-claim data gathering. And I'd also urge the court to look at the recent Research Corporation Technologies case, which we cited in our reply brief, which deals also with a comparing claim. And those were upheld as patent-eligible subject matter. With regard to Claim 20 of the 282, Judge Bryson, you're right, it does stand in a very different posture. The district court held that this claim, which explicitly required growing a transformed cell, was not transformative. If that's not transformative, I don't know how anything could be. So unless the panel has further questions for me, I'll try to save the remainder of my time and surrender the podium.
We will save it for you. Mr. Hansen.
May it please the court. Myriad's entire legal argument in this case turns on its assertion that isolated DNA is different than DNA.
Would you mind starting with standing first?
I would be happy to, Your Honor.
Because I think that the government is also going to speak to the DNA portion, but you're the only one who's going to tell us about standing. So why don't you start with that?
Well, I think Myriad has basically conceded half of the standing argument, which is that the clients, the plaintiffs in this case, are ready, willing, and able to engage in the behavior.
I have a question about that. I think that we need to look at the declarations. You know, I'm sorry to do this to you, but as you know, standing is something the court has to look at, even sua sponte. The declarations of the ready, willing, and able, in terms of the University of Pennsylvania folks, as opposed to all of the others, not one of them says that they would be willing to. They say they'll consider doing it.
That's
correct.
They'll
decide if they want to do it.
That's correct.
Why isn't that your classic Lujan problem? The Lujan, the Sri Lanka Lujan, you know, the Egypt Lujan. Why isn't this the classic, you haven't said for sure you want to do this. You're too tentative, and therefore you don't have a real injury that needs to be redressed.
Well, of course, Dr. Oster, who also was stopped by Myriad's actions,
Ostrin is a different position, but how about the University of Pennsylvania? Because they're the ones that got the problem with Ostrin is he didn't get the same kind of letter.
No, but he was forced to stop his behavior and did, in fact, stop his behavior.
Okay, but with respect to the University of Pennsylvania, you've got a stronger letter, but you've got weaker affidavits.
Why aren't the affidavits
a problem for the reasons Judge Moore has pointed out?
I think what the declarations in that case say is we were sufficiently intimidated that we'd have to rethink our position. But we do this every day. We sequence genes every day. We sequence genes other than BRCA every day. It would be a very trivial matter for us to start sequencing the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, and there's no reason to think that they wouldn't. I agree with Your Honors that the language is somewhat more tentative, but there's certainly no reason to think they wouldn't immediately begin, given the fact that this is what they do for a living.
Well, the reason to think they wouldn't immediately begin is they didn't say it. All of your other declarations, and I have to think this was a very careful wording choice on their part, because all of your other declarations is, I would start it tomorrow. But these two individuals say they would consider. They would decide whether they want to offer it. They may not. And they might not. You're right, it would be easy for them to do, but yet they chose not to say that they would do it.
That's correct.
Is that because they're under the influence of the overriding university?
I think it's partly that. I think it's partly because they're under the influence of the cease and desist letter. I think, frankly, that had a major effect on the university. I think the university is enormously skittish. But we represent the plaintiffs in this case, include organizational plaintiffs, where we have 150,000 physicians and clinicians.
I just need to go one by one a little bit. I hate
that's
to do
fine.
That since you have 150,000 one by one.
I won't go one by one.
But these two have the strongest amount of evidence in terms of the second prong that's necessary for declaratory judgment jurisdiction, the immediate controversy or Myriad having done an affirmative act towards them, which is why I'm focused on them. So do you have any answer at all to the Lujan? I mean, can you distinguish Lujan in any way? Is there anything that you can tell me to make me think I shouldn't conclude that they are exactly within the Lujan umbrella and too tentative to be considered an immediate injury?
Well, I don't think under MedImmune, I don't think they have to be immediately at risk of being sued or, for that matter, immediately prepared to engage in the behavior. I think what is relevant here is that they are ready, they are able to immediately begin doing this, and if these patents are invalid.
Oh, we don't know if they're willing to. That's the problem. Ready. There's a million people who might be ready to do something. But if they're not willing to, that doesn't mean that they've been injured by not being able to.
Well, then there's nothing to suggest that they're not willing. What the declaration says is, given the fact that we've been threatened with a lawsuit, we're going to have to stop and think about whether to do this or not.
Well, yes, but the predicate for their position is that, assuming this, the problem that was entailed in the threat goes away, then what will happen? And there, they still qualify. So it's not as if they're saying, well, we still may be sued. The premise is that there's no problem. Then what do you do? And their answer is, we would seriously, immediately consider.
Actually, so we have an earnest desire to consider it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very qualified.
I recognize that is different than what the other declarations say. That's why we have other plaintiffs. That's one of the reasons we have other plaintiffs and other declarants. The other declarants are equally a threat. If the 150,000 physicians I represent started sequencing tomorrow, is there any doubt in the world that Myriad would start suing somebody?
Do you not recognize the profound impact that would have on our patent system if anyone who was ready, willing, and able to compete tomorrow could bring a DJ action against the patentee in any form of their choosing without any affirmative act directed at all towards them by the patentee?
But I don't think under MedImmune there is a requirement either that there be something directly attacking one of the particular plaintiffs. I think the only question is, do they have a reasonable basis for believing that if they engaged in the behavior they would get sued? And given the fact that we represent virtually every competitor Myriad has, the notion that all of their competitors would start infringing their patents, but they have no reasonable fear that anyone will be sued, seems to me to strain belief. If all of the clients I represent start infringing tomorrow, Myriad has no choice but to abolish its business or to sue somebody. And that's precisely why we have standing here.
Would you mind changing now to the redressability? Because
yes.
It was brought up in the reply brief, but I think that it's a point that I'd love to...
Yes. What is interesting to me about the redressability argument, there are two things interesting. One is that they don't identify any particular claims that they think will get in the way.
Well, probes and primers.
They refer, but in order to look at whether there are claims that get in the way, you have to look at the specific claim. And it might depend on how the probe and primer claims are written. And they very carefully don't identify any particular probe or primer claim that they claim we will infringe on. The second thing is, buried within their argument that probes and primers are an impediment is in fact the assertion that they're going to sue us if we start infringing on their patent. If you want a contemporary threat of suit, that's what their redressability argument ultimately amounts to, is we've got other claims and we're going to sue you if you engage in the behavior, even if you win in court.
Was this, the redressability was raised in this court, I believe, for the first time in the reply brief. Was
that's
it raised
correct.
In the district court at all?
It was not.
Uh-huh. Moreover, I realize this is standing. On the other hand, this is a pretty factual sort of an issue, and it just struck me as something would be difficult for us to sort through the entire record and try to find a particular claim that would be a blocking claim where we haven't been directed and the district court hasn't addressed to the issue of redressability.
I think that's exactly right. It also turns a little bit on the question of whether whole genome sequencing is included within the claims, which we think it is. Whole genome sequencing does not use BRCA1 and BRCA2 probes and primers. The scientists I represent can today sequence the BRCA1 gene along with the rest of the genome without using any probes or primers that Myriad owns a patent for. Mm-hmm. And that's why the problem of Myriad not identifying which claims it thinks are important is significant.
If I take it you took no comfort from Mr. Castanis's response to my question about the whole genome sequencing?
When I read, I did not take comfort. When I read the precise language of the claims, 282.1, for example, a BRC, a isolated DNA that codes for the BRCA1 polypeptide, that's contained in the whole genome. And so if I sequence the whole genome, I own BRCA1, an isolated BRCA1 gene that codes for the polypeptide.
Okay, one last question on this, and then I'll let you move on. But are you saying that the unchallenged primers and probes, the claims that exist, the primers and probes would not be infringed if you get to do exactly what you say you want to do?
That's correct. And in one final point, we don't concede that the probe and primer claims are valid.
We
haven't challenged them in this case, but we don't see them as a valid impediment to continuing.
They not be infringed if you were to practice the invention as you?
There are methods by which we could practice the invention that would not infringe probes or primers in any way, shape, or form.
Okay.
So to turn to the merits, the composition claims, Myriad's entire legal argument here is that the composition, isolated DNA, is different than DNA. Myriad's entire business is built on the proposition that isolated DNA and DNA are identical.
Mr. Hansen, the court held that mere purification of natural material is not patentable subject matter. If I want to make compound C, and I react A with B, and I get C, and I filter off C, there's a little bit of A in it. And to get it out, that's purification of C. Here, what we have is a gene which, in its natural state, is covalently bonded with other genetic material. So it's not just purifying the gene. Isolating is not purifying it. So why didn't the district court err when it focused on purification rather than isolation?
Well, I think, in fact, that cuts exactly the opposite way. All Myriad does here is isolate the gene. All Myriad does is simply snip the gene out of the body.
Well, that's not so easy. I mean, you don't just go in there, and it's not just sitting there.
No, that's right. But the difficulty, we don't reward patents for the difficulty of the work, and Myriad didn't invent the difficulty of the work. Myriad used methods well known in the science in order to do that. And the way Myriad wrote its claims, if I tomorrow invented a way to take a pair of tweezers and simply pull a gene out, I would have infringed on this patent. It wouldn't have been a difficult process, but I would have infringed on this patent. All that this patent requires is that you pull the gene out. Now let's look at the gene once it's pulled out. It has the exact same nucleotides. It has the nucleotides have the exact same
the
composition.
Fact is, you say pull it out as if it's sitting there next to these other two materials, like diamond may be in a mine next to iron and uranium. But it's not just sitting there. Well, this isn't just research by tweezers.
But the claim is written to do that, to reach search by tweezers. Let me give a different metaphor that might be helpful. If my kidney in my body is in its natural state, if a surgeon cuts me open and slices out my kidney and takes it out and holds it in his hand, it's an isolated kidney. But it's still a kidney. It's not an invention.
We don't want any kidney problems.
And the fact that the surgeon used a scalpel instead of a chemical is exactly irrelevant. It just because...
Well, I'm not sure about that, and I think this gets to a really important issue in the case, at least for me. And I'd like to try to draw you out a little on this.
Sure.
There are lots of chemicals. This touches a bit, perhaps, on the bat and the tree that Mr. Castanhas was talking about, right. But in a chemical setting. There are lots of complex molecules which can be changed by lopping off some portion of the complex molecule and creating another molecule which was, in a sense, embedded in the first molecule.
Agreed.
All you've done is broken one or two covalent bonds, and you've created a molecule which A, does not appear in nature by hypothesis, and B, may have functionality that's very different from the original. So why isn't that at least analogous to this setting, whereas, as Judge Lurie's pointed out, you're not cutting in the sense of getting a pair of tweezers or scissors, or for that matter, a scalpel, but you're cutting by a chemical process that alters the chemical identity of the object that's being extracted.
Right, but precisely your example says that the new thing we've created has new functions, and that's what the law requires. It has to be different in character and kind. It has to be markedly different. The Supreme Court uses a lot of different phrases. So let's talk about whether the DNA, the isolated DNA, is different in any of those degrees. Well, Myriad has essentially offered no explanation, and they can't. Think what their business is. You send them a sample of blood, and they isolate the DNA from your blood. They then write you back a letter. The letter doesn't say, well, you've got a mutation in your isolated DNA, but I have no idea what's going on in your body.
But the functionality, I guess, is really the extent to which it's amenable to testing.
Well, but
you can't test the wrapped up DNA in the original form in the body, or at least difficult. But you can test the isolated DNA. So you've established a functionality there.
No, well, you can't use gold while it's in the mountain to make jewelry, but once you take it out of the mountain, it's still gold. My kidney example, you can't transplant my kidney while it's in my body, but the fact that it's an isolated kidney, you can now transplant it. It doesn't make it less a kidney.
The functionality is the same, it's a different material because, as Judge Bryson pointed out, you've broken covalent bonds. If you've got in the body a genetic material of 100 nucleotides, and you make certain cleavages and you pull one out containing 500, that's a different material.
No, I think, with respect, Your Honor, I think not. I think the fact that the way in which you pull the thing out involves breaking covalent bonds as opposed to fibers or veins or arteries or rocks is irrelevant. The relevant question is the thing, once I've taken it out, identical to the thing that was inside?
If it's 500 rather than 1,000. Isn't that right?
Well, half of gold is different than all of the gold.
But gold is gold.
And DNA is DNA. Oh. My time is up, Your Honor, but if I could have 1 minute to talk about the method claims, since Justice is not going to talk about those.
Can I ask you one more question first?
Sure.
The government's not going to talk about this either. They raise a salient point, which is the whole gene versus an isolated part. You would like to have everything invalid, and the government sort of really straddles the middle ground.
Right.
They say cDNA should be patentable, and you do right. have one cDNA claim here. It's claim 2 of the 282 patent. You can say no, but you do. So then the other question is...
I am going to say no, but I'll try and convince you.
But the other thing is, what about the whole gene versus the isolated part? Because just now you were talking about, well, the functions are all the same, but that's not really true, is it? I mean, aren't there a whole bunch of things you can do with a 15-segment piece of DNA, the isolated part, that you can't do with the whole gene? Aren't there all different functions and capabilities?
No.
And the government draws this distinction. So while they're on your side over here, they're not for this purpose.
No is the answer to your question, I think. First of all, none of the claims, including 282, is limited just to cDNA. The claim is DNA that has the sequence. There's some degree of ambiguity in that. If you then look to see in the specifications, they make it very clear that includes not just cDNA, but, quote, genomic DNA, quote, including the introns. Myriad is not claiming any patent. None of the claims in this case refer solely to cDNA. But second, talking about the functionality, Myriad identifies really only two functions other than the ones we've talked about, the probes and primers functions. Those are only a function. It is true that isolated DNA can be used as probes and primers. In so using them, all you're doing is replicating the way the body uses the DNA. You're using the DNA to bond to the opposing strands. It's exactly what the body does. Moreover, probes and primers are in the same as gold can be put in a jewelry once you take it out of the body, so too you can use the probe or primer as the DNA as a probe or primer, but that doesn't make it anything different. It's still the same DNA.
Mr. Hansen, you have...
Could I ask just one quick question? I mean, are you familiar with the notion of a racemic composition?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I am not.
Racemic.
Sorry. Okay, well, I'll leave it there.
I recognize I'm way over, Your Honor.
You are way over. If your colleague wants to cede time to you, then that's up to him.
Can I have 2 minutes? 1 minute? I just want to address the method claims since they're not going to. With respect to the method claims, Your Honor was quite correct in suggesting that all they involve is comparing, and let me give you this example. If there are people who put their entire genome sequence on the web, in addition, the BRCA1 sequence can be found on
the web. Why don't you respond to the Prometheus argument about determining?
I will do that. Let me finish and then I'll do Prometheus. If your law clerks went back to your chambers and put the whole genome sequence of someone like Professor Church at Harvard and the BRCA1 sequence side by side on your computer screen, and you went back into chambers and all you did was let your eyes go back and forth between the two to see if they were the same or the different, George Church, who sequenced his own gene, would not have infringed the method claims. Your law clerks would not have infringed the method claims. You would have infringed the method claims. Now, with respect to Prometheus, Prometheus does in fact involve transformative activities, and in our view, the process of sequencing DNA does not involve any transformations, and the process of comparing doesn't involve any transformations. And my example explains exactly why that is. You don't have to isolate the DNA in order to compare the two pieces of DNA. You all would have infringed just by looking back and forth and thinking to yourself that they're the same or they're different.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sorry, Neil.
General Katyal, welcome to the court.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Judge Lurie, may it please the court. Certain claims at issue here, most prominently claim one of the 282 patent, fall outside of what the Supreme Court in Chakrabarty called our patent law's expansive and wide view of patent eligibility. Chakrabarty said Section 101 includes, quote, anything under the sun that is made by man.
Counsel, you have this distinction in your brief that you argue, the distinction that I brought up with opposing colleague, not the cDNA one, that one I understand exactly where you're coming from on, but the whole gene versus the isolated segment. You, as I understand the government's position, think one would be unpatentable subject matter, but the other maybe not? Or should there be a distinction there? Tell me what you think.
So our test is literally, if you had almost a magic microscope, Judge Moore, that allowed you to zero in on the gene, and you would look down and you'd see, for example, chromosome 17 and 13, and if you could see the exact claim to which the patent is being sought in nature, in that sequence, as claim one of 282 does, that itself is something that is a product of nature. And so that would be true if you had the microscope in a wider or a smaller zoom lens.
So the 50 nucleotides would be there, and therefore you think invalid.
If it were a 50 nucleotide sequence as to which the claim is being sought, yes.
There are 50 nucleotides with, let's say, the introns dropped out, then the answer is no.
That's exactly right, Judge Bryson, that the magic microscope wouldn't be able to find, for example, cDNA. You can look and you can look, but it wouldn't be there because it doesn't exist in nature. And that's why this is a very limited position. This is not a position that is going to dramatically undermine the biotechnology industry or destroy all of the patents that the amici are trying to say. That may or may not be true about the plaintiff's broader theory or Judge Sweet's opinion. But this is a theory that just simply says, look to whether or not the product is found in nature or not. As the Supreme Court in JEM said, the relevant test is between human-made inventions on the one hand and products of nature on the other hand.
But the claimed products here are not products of nature. They are bonded to other materials, correct?
That is correct.
Right. So they are not prohibited as being mere purified natural products.
Well, Judge Lurie, I think that's true about lots of different substances in the earth that I think would be patent eligible under their theory, starting with Judge Moore's example of the mineral, and then we could go to, for example, what our brief discusses, lithium, the third element on the periodic table, which exists in natural form in salts with covalent bonds accompanying other material. And only when it was isolated out in metallic form in 1818 were those bonds broken. But I think nobody would think that the third element of the periodic table is patentable simply because it doesn't exist in nature, because the covalent bonds of lithium attach to other substances. Similarly, there are other examples in our brief explaining why, for example, their theory would require, I think, patenting the isolated electron, which again doesn't occur by itself in nature. It occurs as part of an atom, and one could say, well, the ingenuity is, as Denman did by winning the Nobel Prize, in isolating out that electron and trapping it in the Penning trap. But that doesn't make a new invention. He has invented, as Judge Moore said earlier, a process for trapping, for isolating, and so on. But not actually, he hasn't invented the electron. And similarly, if someone discovers, for example, that the pollen of a certain flower cures cancer, that person has discovered the cure for cancer. They haven't discovered the pollen. And as
John Court said, that the claimed materials are simply conveyors of information. That may be true, but the claims don't read a method of conveying information. They claim substances. And whether they convey information or not, they are still substances, correct?
Absolutely, Judge Lurie.
So the focus on the information was a wrong theory.
Absolutely, Judge Lurie. We're not here trying to defend the district court's judgment about information. I think the contours of that are very uncertain, and I think the district court's opinion wouldn't be a wise course to go down. Rather, I think what this court should do is what I think the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, that there's just a cardinal distinction for 101 purposes between products of nature on the one hand and human-made invention on the other. And the mere act of isolating a substance doesn't mean that it is a human-made invention. For it to be so, lithium would be patentable.
You've disavowed the information theory. Are you prepared to disavow the purification theory?
Well, it depends what one means by the purification theory.
It's not purification, as I indicated, of compound C, purifying it of any residual A and B. You're not purifying the gene here. You are making it by separating it from other covalently bonded materials.
Right. So, to the extent that a patent is being sought on A and B to produce compound C, we don't have any problem with that, because so long as C doesn't exist in nature. Steel is a good example. Iron plus carbon equals steel. That is obviously patentable. But I think here, to the extent that in claim 1 of 282 and claim 1 of 492 do something different, they are saying this actual material exists in nature. That's the magic microscope that I was speaking of earlier. And if that exists in nature, that is where our line would be.
And your answer, I take it, to the covalent bond approach to asking if it appears in nature, where the covalent bonds exist in nature and are broken through the purification / isolation, is lithium, is the lithium type
is
example?
Is the lithium example, I would also say,
examples?
Well, I would say, sure, I think uranium, for example, you have the same problem. When uranium is purified, it also breaks the bonds from 235 to 238 and the
like. We're probably getting into facts that aren't in the record, whether
talking
about the metallic lithium or lithium carbonate.
Sure. And my only point is to say that this is a cardinal view about 101. The covalent bond argument hadn't been, to my knowledge, briefed, and it's not before the briefs. It's not before you specifically, and I'm not sure that there is any precedent for the notion that covalent
bonds
are relevant.
But the inventors didn't purify the claimed gene, did they?
Excuse me?
The inventors didn't purify the claimed gene because it wasn't in the natural state contaminated with something. It was bound to other materials so that it was another material.
Right. If that's the way you've defined it, purify, I think that's right. Our simple point is whether you call it purification or isolation, just look to, does this substance itself exist in nature? And Judge Bryson, to return to your question about covalent bonds, I think all that the covalent bonds theory would do is suggest that someone may be using a process to break bonds, to isolate a substance. But it doesn't answer the question, does that substance itself exist in nature or not, whether bonded to another material or not?
Part of my concern is, in the bigger picture, what about B12? What about antibodies? What about? There's about a million things I could thrust out at you right now that antibodies exist in nature. Your body will produce them. But when you inject a little bunny and you make him produce the antibody so you can inject him in a human being later on, those antibodies are not patentable. But we've got all these cases. I mean, granted, they're very old cases, but cases saying those things are patentable.
Judge Moore, I think overwhelmingly the body of early cases goes the other way. The Marden cases, the Mertz case, and so on, all suggest that mere isolation or purification of a substance that exists in nature is not patentable. And as we turn the clock forward to today and think, what is the real-world implication? The examples that they've cited all boomerang on them. For example, they talk about Taxol. Well, Taxol is not a product. The bark of the yew tree, that product was not, the composition was not patented. Only the process was patented. And that, I think, goes to the fundamental point, which you were getting at earlier, which is process patents are, of course, okay in this area and will provide the correct incentives and the like. The relevant question is, has someone, by inventing a process, somehow invented the substance itself? That's the flower example and the pollen that I said earlier. And so I don't think that this is some dramatic theory that undoes things. I think, frankly, every example that is in the briefs, aspirin and the like, turns out
to
not.
This is not a dramatic theory that undoes things. The PTO has been allowing these patents for 35 years. Mm-hmm. I think that this is a pretty dramatic theory that would undo a lot of existing patents. Well,
I certainly didn't mean to say that it doesn't undo things in the area of DNA. I was responding to the other types of area, the other places around. Now, with respect to that, the PTO, as our brief at pages 6 and 18 acknowledges, has granted patents for isolated DNA. Now, the vast majority of those patents are for cDNAs, recombinant DNAs, process claims, and the
but
like.
But they have guidelines, and the guidelines clearly address this point, and the PTO guidelines conclude that this is, the very thing you're arguing now is not patentable subject matter, are patentable subject matter. And I notice those guidelines have not been pulled down off the website. They continue to be the view of the PTO. So while you're here representing the government, I'm not sure what that really means, because it seems like we have a split in the government.
So if I could address that for a moment, there are, of course, the utility guidelines that were issued in 2001. And after Judge Sweet's decision in this case, as well as a concurrence by a member of this court last year in the Intervet case, we took, the U.S. government as a whole, including the PTO, took a comprehensive look for the first time at this whole question about DNA and what is and is not patentable, a high-level comprehensive review. And in the course of that, we decided two things. First, that the majority of what the PTO has been doing, the vast, vast majority, has been absolutely appropriate. That is, patents on cDNAs, processes, recombinant DNAs, and the like. With respect to the area of isolated DNA, we do think that the PTO is wrong, and it is the U.S. government's position that opinion that we couldn't write a brief that allowed the patentability of isolated DNA. For to do so would be to make lithium patentable, uranium, coal from the earth, and a whole variety of other substances, perhaps even base individual nucleotides. And we just couldn't do that, despite the fact that we give not just the thumb on the scale, but the elbow on the scale to the Patent and Trademark Office and to our client agencies as we are trying to evaluate and come to a position. It was just impossible to do, given the Supreme Court's clear guidance in Chakrabarty and JEM, that there is a fundamental distinction in 101 between human-made inventions on the one hand and products of nature on the other.
I guess my question kind of goes to a notion of stare decisis. About has Congress has never spoken to this. 101 is broad. To the extent there are exceptions, they're judicially created. And I get a little nervous expanding the umbrella in light of 35 years of industry development, in light of the fact that there's clearly a split within the executive on this point. You know, the PTO has adopted over many years a single position, and now, 35 years after that started, here we have a different position by the government. So why isn't stare decisis a concern? Why shouldn't Congress figure this out, not us?
Absolutely, and I'm here as a friend of the court that we went through exactly the same process and asked exactly that question. And ultimately, like Chakrabarty and Bilski, we said, this is really a fundamentally legal question. And the Supreme Court has taught us time and time again in Rapanos and Solid Waste that congressional acquiescence alone shouldn't be the basis by which you adhere to a prior position, particularly on a pure question of law. This is a pure question of law, and to defer to the 35 or so years of what has happened before really is to undo one of the central tenets of what 101 is about, the distinction, core distinction between products of nature and human-made invention.
General,
is it fair to say that you would take issue with the Park Davis case, Judge Hand's 1911 decision?
I think ultimately our theory probably would in the extreme. I don't think you need to get to it here because what Judge Hand said there is if the purification created a different substance that was so different in kind that it did something differently, then that would be patent eligible.
Well, and what is your position with respect to that?
With respect to that, certainly claim one of 282 and 492, the DNA has the exact same function in and out of the body. Now, with respect to Judge Moore's question about primers, I think it is fair to say that there is something of a difference in function when primers are taken out of the host cell. I don't know that, and again, this goes to the ultimate reasoning of Judge Hand. I think at the end of the day, if the court were to follow that, it would be saying that differences in function alone are enough, and that would make coal patent eligible, isolated electron, lithium, gold, all the things have a different function when isolated out.
So you're uncomfortable with the if it's purified enough to create a functionally different... In other words, I even think aspirin may be a case in which, if I recall the aspirin patent dispute, the original substance had too much of the salicylic acid that had upset the stomach, and the invention was to get the purified acetylsalicylic acid, which doesn't upset the stomach, and that was considered patentable by virtue of the elimination of the impurity. But you seem to be uncomfortable with that.
I do think that I am ultimately uncomfortable with it. I don't think the court needs to go there for purposes of claims right. 1 of 282 and 492. With respect to aspirin, I do think that that's not correct, that aspirin was created by treating salicylic acid, which is a naturally occurring substance,
right.
with acetic anhydride. And so it was a combination of two things with respect to aspirin. It wasn't a naturally occurring product. Aspirin would be okay under our test, under our magic microscope test.
Thank you, General Katyal. Mr. Castanis has some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Judge Lurie. With respect to jurisdiction, Mr. Hansen said we threatened to sue them in our brief. I don't think you'll find that in our brief. On the question of redressability, Mr. Hansen says, oh, they haven't identified which claims would be infringed. I don't think they can put us to that test at this point any more than they can force us to either give them a covenant not to sue or sue them at this point. You know, Prasco and Innovative Therapies say you don't get to put the patentee to that choice to create declaratory judgment jurisdiction. It's their burden to prove jurisdiction, and they don't have a redressable claim here. They say they need probes and primers, and in fact, to Judge Bryson and Judge Moore, to your point about this not having been ventilated before in the district court, they're the ones who raised this in their red brief, indirectly, mind you, because they kept telling the court, oh, this is just a modest challenge, there are only a few claims, and then they go on to talk about how important probes and primers are. Well, we've got probes and primer claims. Do we have to say right now we're going to sue them for infringement? Absolutely not. The law doesn't require that. You asked about Dr. Oster. If you look very carefully at Dr. Oster's declaration, you will see that in 1998, when he received the letter from Myriad, all he was doing was sending samples to Dr. Kazazian, the one who today says, I don't know if I'm going to do this or not. So whatever dispute he's got with Myriad now isn't based on that, because Kazazian is very dubious about whether he's going to do this. He'd like to do it. Judge Moore,
he's got... Dr. Oster is not dubious about it. He says flat out he will.
No, he says he will. He says he'll do it himself, which is entirely different conduct than he was engaging in 1998. So I'm not sure where that gets him. But let me turn to the composition claims. General Katyal has proposed the magic microscope test. I hope that his magic...
You've got a kitschy phrase.
Huh? It is a catchy phrase, and I really hope
kitschy,
his magic...
Kitschy.
Oh, it's kitschy, too, yes. But I found it catchy. I found it catchy because I hope that his magic microscope is an invention. because his invention that allows you to see into somebody's DNA, that's what our isolated DNA does. Those DNAs are an invention because humans extracted them from the body, isolated them, purified them, broke the bonds, made loose ends, separated it substantially from all of the other materials around it, and
you say
made
isolated
them useful.
And purified, but all you did was cut off the other stuff.
You say all we did. There's a lot more to that. We first of all had to find it.
I doubt that it was really hard, and I'll never understand it. I don't doubt that.
Nor me.
But the bottom line is you just extracted something.
Well, you just extracted it, and that's like the government saying that mere purification. The word mere in this case drives me batty, in part because it's not a usable standard. It's no
does
better than markedly different.
Does the sequence exist identically in nature?
Does the sequence of cells, the sequence of letters? Yes. Does the sequence of that is symbolized by the letters? Excuse me. Yes. Is genomic DNA in the body useful for all of these uses? Absolutely not. The same thing with the baseball bat. It's inside the tree. It
what
has the same hardness.
For all of these uses, what uses are you talking about?
We're talking about probes. We're talking about primers. Well, we're talking about sequencing
the templates. Government's position is that those probes and primers, because of the very different functionality, and because you've peeled off stuff so that when you look through their magic microscope, it's not there, are patentable subject matter. So, but they're, as I understand their position, it's that, you know, claim one is not, because it's broader. It's to the DNA.
It's to the isolated DNA,
right.
just the segment of the BRCA1 gene. And the fact is that became new and useful when it was extracted. And if you want to say just or merely done, well, those are adverbs I can't argue with.
But just so I know, the isolated DNA in claim one, that's not a probe or a primer. The probe and primer claims are other claims.
But it includes probes and primers, and those things.
No.
Okay, but it can be used. It can be used for that function, but it can be used for other functions also. It can be used as a template for PCR, and you can find that in the 282 patent at lines at columns 51 and 52. It can be used as a template for sequencing other genes or other BRCA1 genes. That's it, again, just using the 282 patent as the example. That's at A595, column 15. General Keitel also brought up the JEM case, because I think the JEM case, the utility guidelines, and 25 plus years of practice really are the easiest way to answer this question. You don't have to engage in the line drawing that the Solicitor General asks you to do. You don't have to engage in this markedly different standard, which, as we pointed out, is no standard for future cases, because one judge's markedly could be another judge's markedly. All you have to do is say Section 101 has been consistently understood by Congress and the relevant agency with expertise, in the language of the JEM case, as encompassing isolated DNA molecules, and the PTO and the entire biotechnology industry has been moored on the notion that isolation is enough to show the human invention that's required by the claims.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Final question.
If I could ask, what's your assessment of the lithium example, that being that a particular element, for simplicity's sake, appears in the natural state only when covalently bonded to something else? Does the person who breaks those covalent bonds in the laboratory and produces pure lithium? We'll just use this as an example so we don't get tied up in a dispute about whether this in fact is true of lithium. But if that were the case, that the natural substance is covalently bonded and only found with covalent bonds, but the laboratory work breaks those bonds and produces pure lithium, does that become an invention by virtue of its isolation, whether you call it isolation or purification?
Well, I think the answer is yes. And I think the answer is yes because it probably has new utilities that were not present when it was there in nature. I know that lithium is used generally as a drug. I was an English major. I can't tell you much beyond that. One last point, Judge Lurie. There's been a lot of back and forth about the entire genome in this case. The definition of isolated, which appears in column 19 of most of the patents, I believe, answers this question. It's not the entire sequenced genome. Unless the court has further questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you for a case well argued on both sides. It'll be taken under submission.
Thank you.
All rise.